pad up. It's the Australian Cricket Podcast, and here are your hosts.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Australian Cricket Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Mensel, aka Menners, and joining me this week is the panelist I laughed at when he suggested that Glenn Maxwell should open the batting in T20 cricket, but scores of 145 and 66 at the top of the order would suggest that Paul the Summer Game Dennett was onto something. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Thanks, Menners. If you make enough outlandish predictions, eventually one will come true and all the wrong ones will be forgotten.
Well, I figured I'd let you get your I told you so in early, so we got that in early. And now we are very lucky today. We have a very special guest panellist. He is an award-winning journalist and is the anchor of the nightly Sports Night show on Sky News Live. He joined Sky News in 2004 and has covered two Olympics, two Com Games and a Rugby World Cup. He listens to the show, so he must be a cricket tragic. Welcome to the show, James Bracey.
Hello, Menners. Hello, Paul. It's an honour to be here. The last time I was listening to you blokes, you're actually putting me to sleep. So you did a really good job.
I don't think you're the first listener to say that one.
No, look, the sleeping tablet kicked in right as the show finished on my way back from Rio, but you gave me everything I needed. Didn't get to see a frame of that Sri Lankan test series, and you tell me where it all went wrong. So well done, fellas.
A lot of Australians would say you were lucky not to see a frame of that series.
It's very true.
Yeah, I think the Rio was a bit of a horror show. But, well, thanks for coming on. It's great to have you. We've got a lot to talk about this week. We're going to talk about the T20 International Series in Sri Lanka. We've got a read and react where we dissect the interview with Adam Gilchrist by Mark Howard. And then we're going to hit the main news topics and we're going to talk about the state of cricket broadcasting in this country. So, James, you'll be a big help with that one. But let's start with the T20 series in Sri Lanka. Australia won the series 2-0. But let's start with the first game. Paul, this is where your prediction of Glenn Maxwell opening the batting came to fruition. He was stuck up the order because of an injury to Aaron Finch. And Australia made 3 for 263, which is the highest ever score in T20 internationals and the joint highest in any T20 game. Glenn Maxwell, 145 not out, 9 sixes, 14 fours, 65 balls faced, a strike rate of 223. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, and I'll continue with my outlandish predictions. I think he should be at the top of the order in all three formats of the game for Australia. Whoa. And I know that most people think I'm crazy for saying that, but specifically in
T20. Even Test cricket?
Absolutely, especially in this upcoming series against India. I think that he'd be a great asset at the top of the order with his ability to play on the spinning wickets and with his ability to bowl a bit of spin as well. But specifically in T20, you know, some of his top-edged or barely timed reverse sweeps that will get him caught after those first six overs go for four. And I think that we often don't take advantage of those first six overs enough, and he's the man to do it.
He's the most frustrating batsman. It was frustrating for the Sri Lankan bowlers in the T20s, but the inconsistency has always been a thing that I think has irked Aussies when it comes to Glenn Maxwell. And it's sort of always seemed that he put on the big show when he wasn't under pressure. When we wanted him to get runs, he didn't. When he did get runs, we didn't really need them. And to me, look, I've never been a huge advocate for T20 internationals, but seeing Maxi do what he did, Paul, I'd love to know, so if you have him at the top of the test batting order, who do you partner him with? Do you have him with a Burns like what he plays with Warner, or do you have Warner and Maxwell?
How would that be? Yes. Either none for 200 at lunch or all out for 20 at lunch.
Fans would love that. But back to your point about Maxwell being divisive, he is a lightning rod in Australian cricket, and perhaps he's a victim to his own nickname. I don't know who bestowed the Big Show nickname on him.
And he hates that.
I mean, he doesn't like it, but it's ever since he came onto the scene, he's had this expectation, which he's almost tried to live up to.
I feel sorry for him in that sense. I mean, and there is that huge expectation that he should be putting on the Big Show more regularly. And if he doesn't like the nickname, he should try and get another one out there, or at least try and refer to himself in the third person with a nickname he wants. But look, I love seeing him when he's in full flight. But there's a reason that he's, the selectors are doing what they've done. You know, obviously axing him from the one-day team. They wanted him to come out, put him under a bit of pressure, and he finally produced.
Well, he had a diabolical run of form in one day.
Shocker.
Cricket. And to go from being world beater and then not being able to get off the mark in a number of games, it just really, I think it put the doubts in the selectors about his development, because he looked like he'd arrived after the last World Cup and he's taken a massive step back. So he's opened the batting. He scored 145. He's followed it up with 66. David Warner's already earmarked him as not opening the batting in the next T20 game. I don't get it. I mean, if you strike gold, do you put it back? I don't know. Why would Warner not keep Maxi up there?
See, I'm all about picking on form. Yeah, and no matter what sport it is, I just think you've got to, you know, it's one thing that's irked me about State of Origin footy. Look, and that's, you know, that is with the New South Wales team, that they pick on reputation, go, no, that guy actually belongs there. Well, if he does, why'd you put him at the top of the order in the first place? And then he's produced, you know, two match-winning knocks. Keep him there. You know, find another spot for whether it's David Warner or Aaron Finch and go with it. But look, Maxi in form, he's a number one pick. You've got to have him in there. I'm intrigued to see what they will do with him because of the fact that, one, they dropped him and then they promoted him to the top of the order in the T20s. What happens with him this summer? Will they be consistent with standing him down or will he be rewarded for that? And will it be all three forms? I'd love to see him play against the South Africans.
I think your point's really good around the fact that they're too much on reputation, that Finch is the incumbent, and so their logic is, well, he hasn't done anything wrong, so when he comes back into the side, he comes back and opens again. And that's the wrong way to look at it. You just got to say, what's the best thing to win us the game? Yep. And I think demonstrably it's Maxwell at the top in T20s.
Yeah, I like the way Maxi uses his hands and his wrists to find the gaps in the T20 cricket, especially in those early overs. He just tends to be able to whip that bottom hand through and get the ball over the top. And as you were saying before, Paul, if he miscues one early, it goes for four, so it doesn't matter. So it gives him that license. So I think they should stick with him. Usman Khawaja, he gave him some good support in this innings. I shouldn't laugh because he's had the tour from hell. But he was out there for a while, scored a quick brisk 30. And Travis Head got in the way of Glenn Maxwell breaking the record. So the three highest individual scores in T20 international cricketer, Aaron Finch with 156 of 63 balls with 14 sixes at a strike rate of 248. And Maxi was dead set for getting that. But then in the last two overs, Head sort of manipulated and got most of the strike. He did well with it, but it didn't allow Maxi to break his roommate's record of 156. And interestingly, Australia has the third highest score as well, which is Shane Watson's 124 not out. So for a country that's not known for being good at T20 cricket, we've got some individual brilliance in there.
It's like the inverse of what happens at Test cricket. We win all the time at Test cricket. We don't have all the personal milestones, and some of the other nations who don't win so often do. I like Maxwell, who, when he was asked, were you aware that you were coming up on the record? The correct answer every sportsman's ever given is, oh, no, I'm not aware of anything. But he actually said, yes, I was aware, because Finchie was sledging me about it the whole way through.
It was a good sledge too, back at Finchie, saying he's got to stop showing the tape back at home. Funnily enough, though, when it comes to stats in T20, I mean, all it takes is a century or a decent knock from one batsman and the match is pretty much decided, and usually it's from the team batting first. And that's probably one thing that irks me about the shortest form of the game, and maybe I don't take it as seriously as I probably should, is that, you know, it's not just one innings that decides. Even a one day or a test, the tactics are just so completely different. So look, it's great for Maxi, but I think it's great that he's found form on the T20 stage, but he's, you know, if he's given another chance, man, he's got to have a big summer. He's got to have a really big summer here.
Oh, he needs to score some runs in the Shield as well, because he's not going to South Africa, so he'll get a chance.
Would you use him like Gilly? I mean, at top of the order in the shortest staff and number seven in tests. You know, is that how maybe there's, you know, a solution there?
I'm not sure about
that. Seemed to work for, you know, with someone like Gilly.
Yeah, it's hard for Maxi in the one day stuff because Warner and Finch have really got a good combo in the one day stuff. So you break that one up, and then I don't know about Maxi at Test cricket. He's not. I don't think he's a good enough off spinner to be that fifth bowler. So I think he needs to bat in the top six. I can actually see Glenn Maxwell batting at five for Australia. He has got talent oozing out of every pore in his body, and it's just a matter of harnessing it in the right direction. You can't score these sort of runs in the manner he's done without the ability to do it at Test level. All he's got to do, like Warner, is rein it back and find out a formula to make it work in the longer form of the game, so he can score 100 off 150 balls without it being, you know, so difficult for him. Because at the moment, it's either hit or bust, and he's got to find an in-between.
And that's what he did quite well in this game, where he did take about, I think he had five dot balls to begin his innings, which for Maxi, and I don't think he played a reverse sweep until about his seventh or eighth ball, which for him is very restrained. And I think that's what he liked about opening in the short format. I agree with you, James. In the Test match, he'd be quite good at seven. I think the shorter forms is where he really needs to open. I'd be happy for him to bat anywhere. His overall average in first class cricket is about 40. It's not too
better
shabby.
Than Mitch Marsh's first class average, and he's batting six.
Yeah. Just one other last thing on this that just shows the differences between T20 and Test cricket. Australia 3 for 263 off 20 overs in the T20 in Palakkelly. In the Test match on the same ground, we got bowled out for 203 from 79 overs. bowled out for 161 from 88 overs. Now, I know there's absolutely no comparison, but geez, that's a big difference.
Yeah, numbers speak. And that hammers at home. Where'd it go wrong?
So that record-breaking knock handed Sri Lanka their heaviest ever defeat in T20 cricket, losing by 85 runs, which is a fair margin in 20 overs. Then in the second T20 international, Sri Lanka made a disappointing 9 for 128. Faulkner took 3 for 19 and Adam Zampa 3 for 16. Those two restricted Sri Lanka throughout the middle overs. Australia were absolutely cruising at none for 93. I was ready to turn it off, and then we collapsed to limp over the line. We lost 6 for 27. But again, Maxi was the big story, hitting 50 off 18 balls, eventually finishing on 66 off 29. When he went out, we saw the wobbles against spin. But a convincing 2-0 series victory for Australia in the T20 stuff. But that last game was a bit more competitive, I guess, James, than you were saying the first one. That lower total, I mean, Australia got a massive wobbles. It was like the test stuff.
Yeah, watching that match, just it was actually almost nice to see. It's one thing to win it convincingly off the back of another big knock, but while they fell apart, they still got the job done. You know, that's a good test for them to go, okay, look, it didn't go according to plan, but we still got the result. And sometimes those smaller targets, they can just be a little bit hairy. Look, I've had a massive man crush on James Faulkner for a really long time. I'd love to see him playing test cricket too. He's a match winner with the ball on the bat, and that's great in the shorter forms. But I don't know, there's probably not a place for him at the moment. But
looking ahead to the Indian test series next year, he's a perfect option to bowl those slow cutters.
Oh, they come out the back of the hand like that, the slow. He just knows how to do it.
And we'll need every batsman we can get. So if he's coming in at 8 or 9, he might be able to contribute with some handy runs in the lower order. And yeah, he's had a real tough year. He had that incident in England, and he's bounced back from that. So again, it's like Maxwell, big summer, massive summer.
And yeah. I agree. I think that he's a must.
He should do what O'Keefe's done and give up the drink.
O'Keefe's given up
the drink for 6 months. He's gone on the wagon.
I think Faulkner could be an option to open the bowling in India, where Hazelwood, I think, is a really fine cricketer.
Have you given up the drink, Paul?
I actually have for a while, yeah. For a few months. Not because of any atrocities. Well, none that I remember. I think that Faulkner would be, with his back-of-the-hand stuff. Hazelwood will bowl okay in India, but I don't think he's going to bowl any better than Faulkner. And Faulkner may well produce some magic. And with the bat, who knows what he could do? He could come in number 8 and score 100.
Love him.
Well, that's it for the Sri Lankan tour. The Australians are coming home. I guess a tour that started with so much promise. Australia lost the Test Series 3-0, need I remind you. But we did really well in the white ball stuff, winning 6-1 if you put the one day and T20 stuff together. But I guess this is where we sort of talk about the importance of each format. I mark a tour like this 80% Test stuff, 20% one day stuff. For me, the 80% 3-0 is my overriding mark and feeling about this tour. No matter if they could have won 7-0, they could have won 15-0 in the one-day stuff, but the Test series was so disappointing.
100% with you on that. I think the headline of that whole tour over there is the fact that it was a 3-0 thumping once again on the subcontinent. It's actually quite hard to work out where it did actually go wrong. When you see the sort, you know, when you see the batsman that should have been stepping up in test format doing the job in the coloured clothing, you go, well, why? Well, what is it? Is it upstairs? Is it the way they're conducting these tours? You know, the stuff that we don't see. Have they got the setup right? The hotel, that debate again, should the families be there? Are they there? For how long are they there? Is the training regime right? Then we can go bigger picture and talk
about the coach, Darren Lehman.
Well,
look, I don't think enough's been said about his role. A lot of people were happy to applaud him when he turned around Australia, but he's had some notable failures, this being one of them. I'm not saying sack the coach, but questions must be asked about what he's going to do moving forward to India.
Yeah, and none really do get asked of Darren Lehman. I think even the same, Michael Checker and the Wallabies, you know, got them to a World Cup final last year, and he's been in a very similar situation to Darren Lehman. It's been all praise, but then you go on 6 straight losses, you know, 3-0 series loss to England on home soil. I think Darren Lehman, you know, he's the Australian head coach, but he's in the end answerable for what's happening away from the pitch just as much as what's happening on it. And there, something needs to change. You know, whether it's, well, they've been talking about playing a lot more of the grade, the lower grade cricket over there on the subcontinent, maybe developing a base there? Was Murali the right guy? Is he doing the right things with the Australian team?
I really think it's the style of player that will succeed on the subcontinent needs to go. I think this tour, they were very well prepared, and you looked at it before the tour, and this is where I think the biggest where you can judge the tour. The test lineup was really settled at the beginning of the tour, but now there are plenty more questions being asked.
Yep.
Burns has been dropped. Kawaj has been dropped. There are questions about Neville. The Sox, Stephen O'Keefe was injured. So for a team that was looking red hot at the beginning of the series, all of a sudden, they've come away with an absolute thrashing, and they're in all sorts.
I suppose the test is going to be how they go in India. That there's a chance that this tour could be the making of them in the subcontinent. That it was an absolute debacle, really. But
I think players like Khawaja and Burns probably won't get the chance. They'll pick Maxwell and Faulkner and Sean Marsh from the beginning.
Yeah,
no matter
it's how the Australian team goes in India. Yeah. You know, if Khawaja and Burns never play another game in the subcontinent, so be it. But I think that hopefully they've learnt from this, and hopefully they do make those selections, because there's going to be a huge temptation. Let's say Burns gets picked again, first test of the summer, has a solid summer. Will they have the guts to say, come February? And by the way, I tip Burns to be the top run scorer in this series, so you know, it shows how much I know. But will they have the guts to say, mate, you just didn't perform in the subcontinent, we can't take you this time, we're going to have to take Bailey instead?
I don't have an issue with that. As much as I'm on form, I think it's form in the right places too. And it's, as we've now realised, it's like playing cricket at the SCG, then going off to the Antarctic. You know, it's absolute chalk and cheese. And if he's proved to not be able to perform on the subcontinent, don't pick him, even if he does have a decent summer here.
Now, I think this tour, I'll remember it for two things. The first thing quickly is the arrival of Mendes in those first two tests. Just phenomenal batting. It had echoes of when Tendulkar and Lara arrived against Australia. It had that sort of gravitas, so great performances. But the other issue that I want to touch on, which I think we haven't seen before, is an undercurrent of rivalry between Steve Smith and David Warner. I don't think they're certainly working together, but there is an element that Warner does covet the Australian job.
He wanted it. He wanted it. I think that was, you know, he wanted it before Steve Smith got it. And look, remember the Joe Root incident over in the UK, that didn't help his cause. And yeah, so he's almost got a bit of the warnies about him in the fact that he probably deserves it, but he's always got someone ahead of him that probably deserves it a little bit more. And there's an easy out by saying, look, he just needed to get things right. And that sort of worked against him because someone else came in while Warner was trying to sort his stuff out. And they've kept, you know, Steve Smith has to be the captain for me. But I like the fact that there's someone there, you know, just keeping Steve Smith on his toes a little bit, and that there's someone that can take over when Steve Smith, heaven forbid, gets injured or has a rest like he's just had as well. I think it's healthy for Australian cricket. I like there's a little bit of sting to it all.
There is a little bit of, as you mentioned, that the first summer that Steve Waugh got appointed as captain of the Australian One Day side, I think he got injured for most of that summer. Warnie came in, did the job, and got rave reviews for his on-field tactical performance. Warnie really wanted the job, and I think had Australia not won the 99 World Cup, he possibly would have got it. There's a you know, if you think that Warner really is coveting it, and he certainly celebrated every wicket in the second T20 as though they just won the World Cup. And if it was his decision to open with Maxwell, that was quite good as well. But I agree, I think Smith's got it for as long as he wants, unless something dramatic happens.
They both have the X factor that would make them a good Australian captain. Or Steve Smith and Warner are both going to share the job, because there's no way Smith is going to play every limited overs game. So we'll see Warner get the job. I like they both have that fire in the eyes. And Warner, for him to turn his life around the way he has and completely transform himself, it shows that he's got something, sort of an element to his character that maybe we didn't quite see when he came onto the scene. But now he doesn't drink, he's fit, he's a family man. The way he inspires his teammates, it's a huge turnaround. So I think those two are just going to push each other moving forward. And as you say, it's great for Australian cricket.
Yeah, he's got a bit of old school about him, David Warner, which I like. I think, you know, Steve Smith does too, but they're also very much the modern day cricketer as well. I like the fact that we've now got that ready-made guy to stand up. I've got no issue with them, you know, having a bit of rivalry.
You throw in George Bailey, who can captain three sides.
See, he's a nut. Like, I'd love to see George Bailey back in the test team. I know it's not going to happen. And, you know,
he's a good chance to go to India.
Oh, I think he is as well, yeah.
I would love to. If that could happen, bring it on.
I'm going with him. We're going.
The thing that Bailey's got in India is that middle way that Voges tried to just defend and that didn't work. Smith and Warner kind of played kamikaze and that didn't work. Bailey in the one day has came out and he just had this immediate calm that he would hit a single and just take the easy runs. And it was, wow, this guy is just so accustomed to playing under these conditions.
I'll just never forget the spanking George Bailey gave James Anderson at the Wacker during that Ashes series. Amidst the, he didn't score many runs, but what was it, almost 30 off the over?
Yeah.
It was just great.
In hindsight, they shouldn't have declared. They should have let him get a few more.
So that was the tour to Sri Lanka. I guess Australia powers on in the one-day stuff and struggles in the test stuff.
The one thing I remember from it, what we remember from it, is that straight ball, particularly of Harath, that all the vicious turning off-breaks that you see, every now and again, they just bowl this one that goes straight on and the Aussies miss it. It just seems to happen every time we go to the subcontinent. Steve Smith in the final innings of the test match trying to cut one off the stumps. Yeah. And it was almost like he was halfway through the shot and you could almost say, oh, I've worked for a week to not do this and I'm doing it. I can't believe I'm doing it. I've been bowled. We just can't play the straight ball.
Yeah, and got to give credit to the Sri Lankans too, yeah, with the tactics they used. I think the whole series and the whole trip to probably Kushal Mendes and Stephen O'Keefe were right at the start. The moment we lose Steve O'Keefe to injury, we lose depth in our bowling, and he was in form too.
Yep.
And Kushal Mendes, no one saw that coming, and just seeing what he did, that would have really played on the heads of the Aussies, going, well, we haven't done the homework on this guy, and then you're playing catch-up from the first test on. I think it was almost decided there.
Yeah, I hope we learn from that Stephen O'Keefe injury and take half a dozen spinners to India next year so we're not caught on the hop. So disappointing tour, but Australia now looks ahead to a huge summer of cricket at home. We've got that little one-day tour in South Africa in between. Oh. I think everyone's forgotten about that one already. It hasn't even started.
It's just so silly. I heard Ricky Ponting talk about it last week. Just these, they've just got no meaning, no context.
So it's a five-match series in South Africa and a one game against Ireland in South Africa. How odd.
What is that? What is it? And you're sending...
Scheduling gone mad.
Yeah, right on the eve of a long Australian summer, India, etc. It just, it just doesn't make sense to me.
The best story, though, for that tour is the feel-good story of Australian cricket, where Daniel Worrell has made a massive comeback after being fined for drawing a penis and testicles in a wicket in a club game. He's been called up to the Aussie side. I mean, you talk about feel-good stories. A couple of years ago on the outer, now he's not picked for his art, that's for sure. Because if you go on Google, it's not a very good drawing, but he must be able to bowl a few balls.
What did he draw it with? Is it? It's just like, it's got to be a stump or something. It's just...
As a cricket tragic, though, it wasn't in the protected area, I think. It was outside that. So I don't think it was going to cause any havoc to the actual pitch. So
put you off if you were batting, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, just a little bit.
Now let's move on to the next segment this week. It's usually read and react, but we've changed it this week. It's listen and react. And what we are doing is we are reviewing the Howie Games podcast, episode one, the interview with Adam Gilchrist. It's the Howie Games podcast by Mark Howard. And I guess... just to sort of outline the idea of this segment, because it's a newish segment, is when we're listening, reacting, and read and reacting, we're not doing it to take pot shots at people or to criticize people for their work. It's more about the way in which people interact with our great game and the sports people around them. The first week we did a Steve Smith article. Last week we did an article in England about the way they reacted to the world record score. So, when we get into this week's thing, we're looking at the way in which people digest this great game. Now, let's start with Howie Games in the podcast. I think Australia has been crying out for a long-form sports interview podcast. I love listening to podcasts, and there's a lot of great ones where they interview sports people in America for a long time, but you don't get many here. What do you guys think about that?
Absolutely. And I think Howie is just so made for this form of podcast as well. Knows his stuff. We know him, obviously, for what he does with the Big Bash coverage on 10, but he's across, whether it's motorsport. I was poolside with him at the Delhi Commonwealth Games with the swimmers, and he's
on radio in Melbourne.
He is, Triple M. So he's made for this kind of thing, and he's such a chilled soul as well. And I just think this, sitting back, chatting with sports stars, it's very Howie.
And it's you're right, Ben, is that it's good to hear the famous people away from the topical and being able to just relax, be reflective on various things and not feel as though they're under any pressure. give them a long length of time to be able to muse on things. And it makes for, I think, fantastic entertainment.
Yeah, it's just something about that longer form with someone that they sort of open up as it goes on. And when we get into the nuts and bolts of this Gilchrist interview, you know, the way it warms up and Gilchrist opens up to sort of stuff, it feels like you're involved in the conversation somehow. So I thought great stuff for Howie to get this podcast off the ground. I think he's got a load of huge celebs, like cricket and sporting personalities lined up. So have a listen to it. Let's start with the music. So Howie's got the old Hawaiian campfire music. I wasn't so sure when I turned it on the first time, but it actually kind of grew on me. It's got that kind of campfire vibe, sitting around with the guitar. What do you guys think?
It breaks that sporting mold, you know. It could go the wide world of sports, sort of, yeah. You know, 45 seconds of, you know, cricket commentary, etc., you know, highlights of this, that and the other. But it sort of sums up Howie a little bit in the end, you know, and it does sort of get you nice and relaxed, I reckon, Paul.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, My taste in music are basically, I love John Farnham, so I've got no qualifications here, but I thought it was quite
all
pleasant.
Right. All right. A few sledges there. Anyway, I think this was a good one for Howie to start with, because obviously they worked together on the Big Bash, so they were comfortable with each other. And Gilly's a great talker. I don't even feel like Howie needed to be there for this one. He just needed to turn the mic on and just let Gilly go. Yeah. But a great format. Now, let's get into some of the negatives of the format now. I at the end of the show, now, Howie's got... I love his kids' nicknames. Let me get that. I love the Pickle and the Big Penguin, Howie's kids' nicknames. I wish my kids were called that. And I think they should probably have their own podcast, the Pickle and the Big Penguin Show. But at the end of this interview with Gilly, there was quite an intense period of reflection, which I really liked the way Howie was able to put that to Gilly, something not just your average run-of-the-mill question, but where he sees his future going. And it was a really good way to end the show. But then at the end, he put in a question from his kids. And I kind of thought it brought the tone of the podcast down. What do you guys think?
It's the beauty of you know, early days in the podcast as well. So
don't listen to the first few shows.
Well, that's it. They're almost trial runs, and that's, you know, when you're developing something like this. And, you know, hosting my own sports show over the years, I look back at I think back to episode one. I can never watch myself back on TV, but I think back to it and I look at where it is now and the tweaks and changes along the way, and you go, oh, yep, so glad I changed that. Can't believe
I
did that.
Do you never watch yourself?
Cannot listen or watch myself back, which is probably a bad thing, because the first thing...
Do you have someone giving you notes?
Well, no. Except my wife. Yeah. And they're just sledges anyway, usually during the show via text message. A big confidence boost, that one. But yeah, maybe it's something Howie could do at the start. Good icebreaker. You know, he's, you know, big, you know, breaking question from my kiddies before we really get into the nitty gritty or something like that. But yeah, these things, they evolve over time, and yeah, you know, Howie knows that as well. So, well, I love the kiddie involvement too, though. Doesn't Howie,
I like
sort of,
the way he
I want to be
heart.
One of his kids.
Yeah, he just, I yeah. Like he brings some heart into the show, and I get that. Just think when you have someone like Adam Gilchrist opening up to you, you want to open the door further rather than perhaps sort of back away with a surface question. But what do you think, Paul?
It's something that didn't occur to me when I was listening to it, but I kind of take your point. But I think that the overall show, as we all agree, was really good. And I found the fact that Gilchrist talking about his insecurities just amazed me, because for me, he's always been... I think he's the best cricketer I've ever seen. And I think I put him at number one of all cricketers I've ever seen. The fact that he talks about still, of how he mentioned how he gets a little thrill when he gets an SMS from Ricky Ponting, and Gilchrist kind of said, yeah. It's like Gilchrist's almost in awe still of some of the players that he played with, and yet I think he's every bit as good as them, if not better. I think it was amazing insight into a player at that level.
Yeah. Let's get into some of the nuts and bolts of what Gilly said, because there's lots of really interesting stuff in there. Well, what you were saying about Gilly being the best, and he talked about a quote Peter Roebuck wrote saying that cricketers wear a cape of bravado and that Gilchrist wore that cape better than anyone else. And I guess Gilchrist was just able to put all those insecurities behind when he got out there. And you know, that quote from Roebuck, it's interesting that Gilly picked up on that as something that he associated himself with.
I think some of them wear a cloak of bravado. I think others of them are almost... I think some of the really successful ones don't think about it enough to have that need, that they just are. I think Warner maybe doesn't need one. I think Gilchrist is a sensitive, intelligent guy. Maybe he did need one, but not everyone does. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Mitchell Johnson was a classic guy wearing his heart in his sleeve. I think it came naturally for him with that bravado. Look, I just listening to Gilly, you're so right, Paul, about the Ponting thing and how he gets excited getting a text from him. Hearing about how he didn't want the captaincy. Yeah. We speak earlier about a guy like David Warner and Steve Smith, who obviously look at it like we would. We just go, as if you wouldn't want to be the Australian captain. It's like someone turning, saying, I don't want to play State of Origin footy. Well, of course you do if you're a rugby league player. Who doesn't want to play State of Origin?
Exactly.
But just hearing that Gilly sort of went, nah, not really, not for me. That was like, whoa. That wasn't some huge secret, but just hearing his rationale behind it, and he grew up in an era where obviously there was a Ricky Ponting ahead of him and he was always going to be the deputy and stepping up in those times. But
maybe that's a little bit to the way he saw his family, because that's something that came across the battle he had playing cricket and having a family at the same time. And I guess, as you know, we've got families, you don't think about that on the cricketer scale, but that battle he had, it was a very personal battle. And I thought he was able to talk about that and bring us in a little bit.
Yeah, and even hearing when he was on tour, Paul, when they were over there and he had the family there, but then was like, actually, I sort of don't want you here. Yeah. And when his wife goes, I think we're going to go, he's like, you beauty, this is, it's a good thing, because it can be, you're sort of getting that insight into, we all think it's all cushy, they're in 5-star hotel, living the dream, but it just didn't sound like that. It was interesting sort of getting his view on that.
Well, and that particular incident where he talked about the Manchester 2005 being the low point of his cricketing career, and I remember that game really well, and Australia were battling to probably try to save a draw, but at the time Gilly came in, Ponting was going really well. There was still a faint chance Australia could have won the game. Gilly played an unusual inning. He defended about 30 balls, and then he smashed one for 4. And I remember the surge of excitement watching it, thinking, wow, they've had a chat and they're going to go for the win. And then he got out next ball, and I thought, oh, well, there you go. Totally unaware of the whole circumstances surrounding it, that Gilchrist was on the point of the low point of his career, that the team were angry at him, that he wasn't spending more time with the team. Family life was going poorly, and it was just everything was going wrong. You just don't realise that there's more to it than the cricket itself.
Yeah, we just view it in the context of sporting theatre, but we just have no idea the backstories. Yeah. And that's why conversations like this, coming back to the main point of the discussion, conversations like how he's having with these athletes, in hindsight, we can look back at it now, and you'll forever look at that as you are, Paul, totally differently, rather than through the context of just being a cricket match and maybe Australia's falling apart. You go, well, there is a reason.
Also, when there's murmurings when Australia's on tour that there's things happening off the field that are affecting performances on the field, and people go, oh, you should be able to put that stuff behind you. Sometimes it's evident from what Gilly's saying, you just can't. Mm. It's hard to leave everything at the gate when you walk out to bat. I think we need to take one lesson going into the subcontinent from Gilly, because he was the captain when we won in India in 2004, and he said you need to go negative to be positive on the subcontinent. And I think the current Australian cricket team needs to adopt that mantra going forward in the next tour of India, because we saw the ultra-aggressive attitude didn't work this time. So I think that little bit of gold from Gilly, I think they should look at that one. Use it as a bit of material.
And along those lines, Gilly also mentioned that he said we were great whingers when we went to the subcontinent. And in 2001, they decided enough. They didn't win in 2001, but they almost did. And then they won in 2004. And I think that they had the attitude that not everything's going to go right. It's not what the conditions we're used to. We're just going to have to suck it up. People would say, well, this time around, Australia were complaining about the footholds and various different things. India, when they came out here, I remember Ishant Sharma stormed out of the Gabba to get some better vegetarian food than what was offered at the Gabba, even though I think it was fine, it was just a little bit boring. You sometimes got to say, when you're touring away, let's just say, let's focus on the win and let everything else, all the whinging and everything else, drop to one side.
There's always so much when it comes to Australia, India, isn't there? Even if it's here, not necessarily just over there, but there's so many good stories that come out of that series. That's why I'm super pumped about this next one.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I'm not so pumped, because I don't think it's going to go so well for Australia. I can't see us turning around, but that's a long way away. Maybe something will turn around. And let's just, before we leave the Gilchrist podcast or the Howie Games interview with Adam Gilchrist, and if you haven't listened to it, please listen to it. It's a great podcast.
Yep.
Now, the one thing that Gilly had was he went through every player at the end, and that was very interesting, the way he sort of talked about his teammates. But the one I circled around was Gilchrist talking about Michael Clarke and the way he tiptoed around the issue without actually saying what he was thinking. So he alluded to the fact that Clarke was a manufactured cricketer, and that there was a contradiction in Clarke that he says is this real Westie, but he doesn't act like it. And he sort of almost says that Clarke was put on a path from a young age to be Australian captain. I wouldn't say he questioned Clark's desire, but in a roundabout way he did, or he questioned his motivation. What is your guys' interpretation of his comments on Michael Clark?
It sort of summed it up perfectly, I thought. I think Gilly probably went further than a lot of other former and current cricketers have on the topic of Michael Clark. And I think that it was that contradiction, the one where it is, you know, he's a boy from the West and he does milk that and makes it very public, but he acts and is a guy that lives in the East when it comes to Sydney. He lives, you know, enjoys living the high life, which does in the end sort of contradict the roots that he very much promotes. He, has there been a cricket that's polarised the Australian public more than Michael Clark? No. There was times where you wanted to give him a hug and you loved him. There were times where you wanted to slap him in the face. And you do get the feeling that a lot of the cricketers that played with him at the top level certainly felt both sides as well. And they've seen a lot more than we have. And I think there's a lot more to Michael Clark than we know. Look, in the end, I thought hearing Gilly say that sort of hit it home for me, going, yeah, look, I think there was a bit of ice to him that in the end didn't sit well with a lot of his teammates. I think especially those ones that had gone through the 90s into the 2000s and saw this next generation coming through.
I also just found his talk about his own relationship with Shane Warne being fascinating, how there's always been a little bit of a feeling that maybe Gilly and Warney don't get on so well. And he kind of addressed that and said, we're not perfect, but we kind of enjoy each other's company. But the thing that he said that was interesting was, and I find this one of the endearingly amazing things about Shane Warne, that he genuinely thinks Warne started to freeze him out a little bit when Gilchrist was selected for the Australian side, for the Test side, instead of Darren Berry. Warne has this belief that Darren Berry should have been in the Australian Test side. Darren Berry is a very good cricketer, but the chances of him being picked at that stage over Gilchrist were 0.000%. It's just bizarre.
As you say, the comment about, you know, when Gilchrist would miss a chance off Warne, and then Warney would be standing next to him at first slip.
And he'd feel the silence.
Yeah, and I don't know, if you've ever played cricket, I mean, that's the worst feeling when you go stand next to a bowler, and you can imagine Shane Warne wouldn't let it go.
Oh, the wrath of Warney's silence. Couldn't you just imagine what that'd be like? But as he said, then he'd go get the scalp in the next over and all would be okay. But if it was a match-defining moment and it didn't go your way, you wouldn't want to be around him.
Now, if you want to get in touch with the Australian Cricket Podcast and let us know what you think of the Howard Games podcast or any other stuff we've been talking about, email us on Gmail, AusCricketPod, AUScricketPod at gmail.com. We're also on Twitter at AusCricketPod, AUScricketPod. You can find us on Facebook as the Australian Cricket Podcast. There's plenty of apps to listen to the show on, pretty much every podcast app. We are on it, Acast, Stitcher, Podomatic, we're all there. So please rate the show, review the show on whatever app you're listening to the show. And we'll be back in a moment with the commentator critique.
Well, it's in the air and up she goes. Not out, says the umpire. He's walking. Wow, there we are. That's great to see. Here we are in the semi-final of World Cup cricket and Adam Gilchrist has played a sweep shot. They've gone up. The umpire didn't look to me as if he was going to give him out and Adam Gilchrist has walked off the ground. That is great.
Welcome back to the Australian Cricket Podcast. That was Adam Gilchrist walking off, giving himself out. And at the time, he copped a lot of heat about that decision to walk off. But my feeling now is with the passage of time, and actually his decision to walk off looks better. What do you guys think?
Yeah, when's the last person we saw walk? I'm just trying to think these days. I mean, I guess the video technology, that sort of changed the way it all sort of unfolded. I mean, because you could see moments.
You don't have to walk now, do you?
Well, you don't really, unless you're playing, India?
But I just think the way Australia in that moment was so intense, huge, about winning every game. And, you know, Steve Waugh was just that end of his era where we had a win-at-all-costs attitude and Gilchrist kind of didn't 100% buy into it.
But was it the high road that he took or was it... Because I think Australia was really conflicted on that one where it was, where do you draw the line? Yeah, where do you draw the line between winning and winning at all costs? And, you know, Gilly, maybe...
I think he moved the game forward and I think... As I said, in the passage of time, I think it looks better because I don't think that winning at all cost attitude did Australia's reputation as a cricketing nation any favours.
I wouldn't be surprised if he suddenly found himself walking off before he even realised he was doing it. It's sometimes just an instinctive thing. I hit the ball, off I go. And then he thought, geez, I'm doing this.
No, he knew what he was doing. Because the umpire shook his head, said not out. And then
I'm saying it was kind of instinctive. what I remember once, Malcolm Speed, when he was in charge, was interviewed on ABC, and Kerry O'Keefe said, why don't we make walking compulsory? As in, just write it into the laws that if you don't walk, then you're going to have the, like a dive in soccer. And he had no answer to it. And I think it's an intriguing idea. A lot of people are really anti it. They say, you know, umpires, are their job's to make the decision. But if you did say, if you nick the ball and you don't walk, then we're going to throw the book at you. There are very few times when you can genuinely be unsure. If you say I'm unsure, that's fine. But if you're someone who says you're unsure all the time, it'll soon become apparent. I think it'd be interesting.
This goes on your list. Maxi opening the batting, no balls, batsmen have to walk. You know, this is that throw a few balls up in the air, one will land.
But now it is silly when, for example, last summer when Nathan Lyon knew he hit it, he was waiting to walk off. They gave him not out because they made a mistake. If he had just had to walk off, he would have just walked off straight away. There would have been no controversy. The right result would have occurred. I'm not saying it's the way it should go, but I think it's something that's worth discussing.
Yeah, look, that's why we have been discussing it. Now, let's move on now to the commentator critique. And this week, it's a little bit of a change. We're not getting into individual commentators. We're just going to talk about the state of broadcasting in this country because we've got a professional sports broadcaster here. Looking forward to James' opinion on some of the people in the commentating landscape. But there's been two sad bits of news in commentary this week. Firstly, Michael Clarke is going full-time into the Channel 9 commentary box. And also, we lost the great Norman May yesterday, one of the doyen voices of all Australian sport, not just cricket, but he was across everything. So really sad to lose Norman May's voice. I remember him, cricket's particularly in the early days of ABC TV coverage. He was one of the real fixtures there. So sad to see Norman go.
Yeah, he called it all too, didn't he? You know, that's the thing. He was just such a great all-rounder. I had a chance to meet him 4 years ago leading into the London Games, interviewed him, and he's just sort of like, you're like, I can't believe I'm doing this right now. Is this really happening? And why am I asking questions? Let's just give this guy the microphone for 5 minutes.
That's how I feel right now.
Look, unfortunately, it's just the way it goes, isn't it? Every now and then we're going to lose. You know, as we've seen with Richie and Co.
He had a good innings, didn't he? 88. Good innings. Good knock.
Yeah. I most remember him from being the voice in the Bodyline miniseries, which came along when I was about 7, probably before you were born.
How many times have you seen that? That's your biggest source. One of your biggest sources.
Is what, the Bodyline miniseries? Yeah. That's how it's informed everything on cricket. No, when you watch it again with adult eyes, you realise what a melodrama they made, how parochially pro-Australian.
Yeah, Yabba's so bad in that.
And they make the English out to be villains, which they weren't. But as a 7-year-old, it was perfect.
They probably were. They were. Come on.
But Norman May in that, his voice playing the radio commentator, was just so evocative of the era.
Now, to the first bit of bad news was Michael Clarke going full-time into the commentary box. So that means he is not playing in the Big Bash.
So what's new? How many teams has he signed for in the Big Bash and then not played for?
Can I write a headline, no team wanted him? Yeah. Is that the underlying what happened?
Well, Channel 9 paying a hell of a lot more than the Melbourne, was it the Renegades this time? Or was it Eddie's team? I think it was Eddie's team, wasn't it? The Stars this time?
So, yeah.
And the Sydney Thunder. Look, it's a great decision. And you know why it's a great decision? Because we're having this discussion. Because what we were saying earlier, he polarizes people. So people will want to throw stuff at the television just because Clarkie's either on it or talking while the vision's up. But he's a perfect personality to have. And he's actually quite a good commentator. We know he's got technical nous. He's very good captain. And I just think it's Channel 9's way of getting us to talk about the coverage.
I just don't like him, his banter. When he gets into the banter in the comm box,
you've got to be smart with who you put him on with. It's like any sport. You've got to have the right combinations. And I think last summer that it could have been done better. I think there was a lot of the boys with the boys having a bit of fun, forgetting what they're there for, and that's to bring more out of what's happening on the pitch, and we weren't getting that.
Are there any cricket commentators you really like listening to?
See, maybe it's the nostalgia part, but I still love listening to Ciappelli, and I just think that he's growing up in the 90s as a kid. He and all the old school guys. It's just we're still clinging on to a bit of that through having Ciappelli there, and he's the grandfather of the commentary team now, and he's so wise. I love everything he's got to say.
Ian Chappell. There you go.
Yeah.
I think I agree with you about Clarke, that he's not going to be bland. And that's what some
you reckon?
I reckon he's not going to be bland. I think that he's got an opinion, and the thing that that made him a polarizing figure could make him a good commentator. Yeah. I hope Channel 9 give him a little bit of voice training. You hear Shane Warne talk in the 90s, and compared to now, his voice has improved so much. I think that Michael Clarke could, you know, with his rising intonation at the end of each sentence, they could knock that out of him and make him more listenable to. Yeah, I think he'd be really good.
They all take getting used to as well. I think, you know, and that when it comes to commentary, you're right. He'll hopefully they're giving him feedback, etc., along the way. It's for me, it's what they're talking about that you want them to be divisive. You know, the people are getting cranky about or loving, not their personality and what they've represented. And so I think, you know, Clarkey, you know, Ciappelli, he's honest. And I think hopefully, I know Clarkey's still probably close to a few of the guys out there, hopefully he can step away from that and really cut through.
Now, we've been critiquing basically the whole gamut of commentators. We've gone through Channel 9, Fox Sports, Channel 10. And there's a few themes that have emerged through the varying critiques of the different coverage. So the first one is Channel 9 seems to have fallen behind the Channel 10 commentary box and the Fox Sports commentary box in popularity. None of these opinions were universal, but the trend was against Channel 9, that people really liked the Big Bash coverage. They love Gilly and that whole team, liked the Fox Sports commentators with AB and BJ and all those boys up there. But the Channel 9 was lagging behind. And some of the reasons were coming up. Paul made a good point a while ago that commercial TV has a different reality, that sometimes they have to be a bit more aware that to be broader than perhaps cable TV. What's your take on that?
Yeah, and you've got to remember what they're broadcasting too. I mean, the Big Bash coverage, it's T20, it's fun, it's colour, and I think they do a great job. It's done differently, and I think when you've got, you know, say you might be watching Test cricket during the day and watching Channel 9, and then the Big Bash is on that night, it's chalk and cheese. And I almost don't like comparing the two because it's sort of this completely different products. When it comes down to it, it's entertainment at night in the Big Bash. It's much easier to like, and there's less of it. You've got 3 hours as opposed to eight.
The commentators in the Channel 10 Big Bash commentary have kind of taken on the persona that the original Channel 9 commentary box took on during the World Series days, when one day cricket was so exciting and you tuned in to hear what, you know, Richie and Tony and Bill would say. Now I feel Channel 9's lost that a little bit and it's moved away. So I don't know. It's just, what do you think, Paul?
I think there's some merit. I read that point in the note, so I'd never thought of it that way before. And maybe there's something to it that the Channel 10 guys have almost, in some ways, I think maybe it's overstating it, but they've almost saved Channel 10 as a network. The Big Bash did so well. There would be a great feeling of togetherness and we are doing something special, which is what the Channel 9 guys would have had way back in the 70s. Whereas, and you know, they were hated by the establishment, so they were kind of, would have really galvanised their relationship. I suppose some of them now, Mark Taylor and Ian Healy and Slater have come on board way after that. For them, it's probably just quite an easy gig. Some of the more modern players of Hussey and Lee, the same story. Maybe there's something to it.
We've thrown up the idea that in the Channel 9 box, they should get a three-man team with two cricketers and like a journo or a professional caller as someone to sort of drive discussion and drive the segments forward.
Ask better questions. That's a thing. Yeah, it's a good point. Ask questions that someone not entrenched in cricket would want to ask. Yeah, because there's a lot of people watching these matches, you know, whether it's, you know, wives of a cricket diehard or whatever, who are going, you know, what's that, you know, explain, you know, and just sort of break down the game a little bit.
I think
while it's
like
happening.
Howie does that in Channel 10. He 100%. Often probes the experts he's with, to illustrate things you're not seeing.
And that's it. You've got a non-former cricketer, or at least not, you know, from the super professional level, you know, who know they're outside of it. They know the questions to ask. And I think that's, you know, the one thing I think what we've got to remember too is the Big Bash coverage is fantastic. The precedent was set by Fox Sports. They had the rights to it first. They did an amazing job, increased its value tenfold to the point where Channel 10 wanted it. There was a bidding war, and in the end, obviously, you know, Cricket Australia wanted it on free to air. So to Fox Sports' credit, they turned it into something amazing. Channel 10 have got it, run with it, continue the momentum, and now potentially we might be seeing it broadcast on both.
Well, that's you bring me to my next point, that Fox Sports are making a bid potentially to cover Test cricket simultaneously with Channel 9 and cover some of the Big Bash. Let's start with the Test cricket. My personal feeling is I can't see why Channel 9 would allow it to happen. I mean, why would you potentially cut your market like that?
Well, they've just done it with rugby league. This year that Channel 9 previously had the three premium games of rugby league that Fox weren't able to cover. The reason they did it was Fox paid them $20 million and
Money talks.
And Channel 9 got some advertising onto there as well. But the other thing that I would never have occurred to me, that Channel 9 said, we're happy because it's actually just increased the audience for rugby league. And that they found this year that with State of Origin, which is Channel 9 only, they got higher ratings than ever before. And you can sort of see how that could happen with cricket as well. Fox Sports would show it the love. They would have a dedicated channel that have panel shows, interviews, and you'd a sports fan who's not that into cricket, who
it'd be like
on
the
it.
Sky Sports coverage in England of the Test cricket.
Yeah.
More for the purists.
So let's say Channel 9 gave it to them, the Test matches only, and kept the one days to themselves. Maybe they'd then see that in the one day game, they would have increased the overall audience. Plus, it would mitigate some of the people who are annoyed at the Channel 9 commentators. They could say, well, if you want a more purist version, click across to Foxtel.
It's a great point. And where Nine have reaped, we've seen it with Rugby League, and where they reap the benefits is when they've got the games on their own, like State of Origin or the Grand Final, and they get record audiences. Because you're right, you've got two sources now. Yeah, maybe it is one for the diehards and Fox Sports where there's no ads during play. They've really maximised it.
I'd
got
love
their
to
own
hear
channels.
AB commentating on Test cricket in Australia.
See, and that's we're deprived of that. And that's it. I think it'll keep Channel 9 on their toes. We've seen 7 and Fox Footy with the AFL as well, own dedicated channel. Fox will have their own NRL channel next year. I'd love to see it happen with the cricket.
Yeah, me too.
I'm not sure about the Big Bash, though. If they were to move the Big Bash to Fox Sports away from free-to-air, surely it would harm the overall growth of the game.
Oh, that'd be a disaster. But simulcast would be great. But if they moved it back just to Fox Sports would do a wonderful job. Probably even better job than Channel 10, but just the lack of penetration into the viewing audience would drop because just not enough people have pay TV.
There's got to be a free to air element. I think with the Big Bash, it can't be just the final. Like you've got to have the whole, you've got to have the whole thing. So I would see it less likely with the Big Bash, even if they were splitting some games. But you've got to have consistency as well. So
I guess the value of the Big Bash might determine the way this goes. If Channel 10 or one of the free-to-air networks is not willing to pay the cash, maybe Fox Sports will subsidise it, and we'll see a shared arrangement where there's half-half coverage.
Well,
or something.
You said it, man. As money talks, and that's what it'll come down to in the end. Whether or not there's a whole Fox commentary team on it, or they just do take a simulcast of it with the 10 guys, bit of 10 branding, whether that's a trade-off, who knows. But look, the more, as Paul said, in the end, the more broadcasting of these sports on both platforms, the better.
The one thing I hope that doesn't happen is that if Channel 7 bid an absolute fortune for the Big Bash, there'd be a huge temptation to give it to them. And maybe they do a wonderful job, but it's doing so well on Channel 10. It would be a great pity if Cricket Australia took a bit of extra money and possibly jeopardised what's going on so well.
It was just so heartening last Australia Day. I remember walking around the streets here, and as an absolute cricket tragic, I was so heartened to see almost every street corner and lane, people were playing cricket. I think the Big Bash's prevalence has really brought cricket back into the middle of our summers now, that where it's so good. The way the Test stuff and the one day stuff is fragmented, but the Big Bash has that consistency of every night there's a game. And yeah, I just a long may continue on free to air TV.
Yeah, and you're right, it's that consistency of having it on. Just you just knew there was a game on each night.
What do you think about this? Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, fair crack. The cricketers should play in America on Christmas Day and holidays. All the sportsmen play, and all they do is they just get extra money, which money talks. Let's have a game on Christmas Day. My family suck. So I'd much rather watch the Big Bash than chat with them.
Yep, with you on that. I just love just having it on. Even if you're not watching every ball, just having it. It's like Test cricket during the day. Just, you know, you've almost, and if Fox have got a coverage, you'll have a cricket channel, you'll have Tests all day, probably 3 magazine shows in between that and the start of the Big Bash. You'll be audio.
We'll have Crash's cricket legends on again for you, Paul. We know those word for word now. We've been memorising them. That's how much we watch cricket. Well, let's end the show on some bad news. This is my headline. BCCI scraps 2-tier tests and opts for expanded IPL over commitments to bilateral cricket. Now, I know that's not the actual headline, but that's my reading of it. The BCCI have put a stop to this proposal for 2-tier tests. They've put a stop to the Test Championship. And again, world cricket is at the mercy of what the BCCI wants to do.
This makes me so cranky. I get so angry when
James is shaking his head furiously.
I can't even speak. I'm so angry about it.
It just, the BCCI, like, it's... Oh, just how much control they have. And look, I love T20 as a form of the game. As I said earlier in the podcast, I'm not a huge T20 international fan, but we've got to make sure there's balance. And I just worry for the future of the game, just how much India is controlling and how it's so focused on the shorter forms.
I mean, we had support from Australia, England, South Africa, New Zealand, Pakistan, and the West Indies for two-tier tests. And 72% of the players supported two-tier tests, and yet it's not going ahead because the BCCI are not supporting it.
And even more importantly, we had the support of the ICC, like the governing body. Yeah. In no other sport does that happen. If you know, FIFA said we're making a change
but
to soccer.
But don't you think they got us hopes up a bit? Like, Richardson was so positive about it, you thought, oh, this is going to happen for once.
They should
have
something's
actually going to happen.
They shouldn't have made it public until it was agreed upon. But in soccer, if FIFA said we're making a change to the rules and then Brazil said, no, we don't like it, it would be, well, sorry, Brazil, you know, cop that. I know cricket's different where India is responsible for, you know, 90% of the revenue, but the BCCI never acts in the best interests of world cricket. There should be some mechanism by which if the ICC has made a decision, that's it. India's got a representative. The chairman of the ICC is from India. The decision has been made. Whether it's a good decision or a bad decision, no individual board can comment. It's done.
This reminds me of, sorry, Mez, is the NBC and their Olympic coverage, because they've invested so much money through to like 2032. The swimming finals in Rio, they were on till 12:30 in the morning, just so it fit in nicely with NBC and primetime in the US. They control. It's the Olympics. It's meant to be the most purest form of sport, yet it's a TV broadcaster that controls the whole program. This is exactly the same. You've just got India, whatever they want, they get, and it's wrong.
And the reason India are doing this, to make this clear, is they do not want to commit to the bilateral cricket that would come about through this test championship or two-tier test. They do not want to have to commit to playing it or broadcasting it. They only want to broadcast the cricket where they can make the most money off. So it's really disappointing. I don't know what to say to the listeners, because they've scrapped the test championship proposal. So the best we can hope for is perhaps a playoff between 1 and 2 for the test championship. And I get, as I said a couple of weeks ago, something is better than nothing, but that feels far short of what would have been a radical shake-up.
Yeah. Look, the video technology thing with India, that just sums it up. Exactly. I mean, and once they let them get away with that, they can get away with whatever they want now. And look, I want more relevance about every part of cricket that has been played, every tour. I think going somewhere is one thing, and I know there's a ranking system for all three forms, etc., but I want to somehow over time intertwine everything that happens throughout the year to make even more meaning. And I thought this was sort of one step in the right direction.
Absolutely. And like this, the recent, there was a South Africa New Zealand series that was played in winter in South Africa, which I presume was a practical joke. And you couldn't possibly be interested in that series. But if that was something that could then say, oh, well, if South Africa win this, they go to third, and then potentially they'll make the semi-finals or whatever else, it would have given it some relevance. And this was a chance to have it happen, and it's gone by the wayside.
And I guess Australia's answer must be to develop the strength in the bilateral series now. So I'd like to see more trophies. So I think the Frank Worrell Trophy, the Ashes, or the Warren Murray Trophy, the Border Gavaskar. We need bilateral trophies with every nation. They should have good names. And also perhaps Super Series, where you put together three tests and one day is, and a T20 series, and get some kind of points, and then at the end you get a trophy, because the ICC aren't going to help. So Australia's going to have to go get on the front foot and do this themselves.
Do you reckon we could get that trophy, the Warren Murray one, redone? Those two scary hands coming out of the piece of wood. Oh, it just looks
get
wrong.
Get Rath to mould his hands around it.
And have Murray's eyes in there as well.
Get Murray like in an Australian training uniform.
Yeah, in a baggy green.
Well, listeners, thanks for downloading the Australian Cricket Podcast. James, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week. It's been great to have you on.
Honored to be here. Thanks for the invite, guys.
Thanks, James.
Guys, download the show next week. We're hoping to have another special guest, and enjoy the cricket.
What a marvellous stroke. He's played no better shot than that in the whole of the series.